Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. Wabanaki Windows is a monthly show brought to you by WERU in East Orland, Maine, in partnership with WMPG Portland, Maine. Today's show is part two of Breaking the Silence, in recognition of the Wolastoqe mothers, grandmothers, and aunties' statement. Our guests today are Professor Darren Ranko, who is a member of the Penobscot Nation, and Professor of Anthropology and Chair of Native American Studies at the University of Maine, Orono. We are especially excited to have Rabbi Rachel Isaacs as our special guest today. Rabbi Isaacs was named one of America's most inspiring rabbis in 2014 by the Jewish Daily Forward, ordained in 2011 by the Jewish Theological Seminary, where she studied as a Wexner Graduate Fellow. Rabbi Isaacs is the spiritual leader of Beth Israel Congregation in Waterville, Maine. She is also the inaugural holder of the Dorothy Bibby Levine Elfon Chair in Jewish Studies, teaching courses on Hebrew, Jewish theology, and Jewish humor. In 2016, she delivered the final Hanukkah benediction of the Obama administration at the White House. Welcome, Rabbi Isaacs.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. I'm just wondering, since our last show was on the Wolastoqe mother's and grandmother's statement and the situation in Israel and in Gaza, I thought it would be a great idea to have you on the show and just kind of get some background. And so to start off, I know my audience is not familiar at all, I would guess, with the history of what's going on there. But first of all, I want to ask you about your own background and what sort of made you want to become a rabbi.
That's a great question. So it's pretty rare to have a sense of vocation at a young age. I work, in addition to my work at the synagogue in Waterville, I'm also on the faculty at Colby. And it's pretty rare that somebody comes in knowing what they want to do with the rest of their lives. But I, at the age of 13, at my bat mitzvah, a Jewish coming of age ceremony, I announced from the Bima, the sanctuary platform, I said, when I grow up, I want to become a rabbi. And part of the reason for that is I loved being in synagogue. I loved learning Torah. I loved singing. But I think the thing that I loved most about it is that I grew up in the same town with all of my grandparents. And on all the major Jewish holidays, my whole family would sit in a pew together for, you know, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, depending on the length of the service. And we would all be singing the same song together. And there was something that we did that was more important than work, that was more important than school. And I know that as I was sitting with my grandparents, these rituals connected them to their parents and grandparents. And it connected me to them. And I loved my grandparents very, very much, and my parents too. And I thought to myself, there's something really good and important about a life of faith. And there's something very powerful about keeping a tradition alive after thousands of years and a lot of oppression, that I want to be part of keeping these traditions in this community alive and to give others the kind of comfort and grounding in Jewish life that I got as a kid.
So your faith must have kind of shaped how you see justice and human dignity. Can you talk about that a bit?
Absolutely. There are many texts in the Jewish tradition that talk about the fact that every single human being is created in the image of God. And there's a wonderful text in the Talmud that talks about, you know, why did God create all of humanity with a common ancestor, with Adam and Eve, you know, as the universal parents. And what the Talmud said is that so no human being would say to another, I'm better than you because I came from a better lineage. And I think that that was a very profound statement, especially in the ancient Near East, that, we might all be different in a variety of important and real ways, but there is a foundational common dignity that comes from being created in the divine image.
You maybe talk to us a little bit about the history of Israel and that situation.
So that's a big question, Donna.
Yeah, no, I'm just.
And so anything that I say is going to be partial and incomplete.
Okay,
And
wait, let me rephrase the question, okay?
sure.
Okay. Can you explain the Jewish people's historic connection?
Yes. So can I? Yeah, I think that this is a really important question. And I'll just say that a lot of these questions, these foundational questions about the conflict that we see today between Israel and the Palestinians, which actually is a conflict that started well over a century ago. This is just the latest chapter in that saga. But as we look at the present moment, there's a temptation to either ignore some of those basic foundational questions or to read our current moment into historical trends that are distinct from some of the current dynamics that we see. But the Jewish connection to this, to the land of Israel, is ancient. So it begins with our original ancestors that we're going to read about on Rosh Hashanah coming up next week, Abraham and Sarah. God promises the land of Israel to Abraham and Sarah and to their descendants. And that is a crucial part of Jewish faith and tradition. And even if somebody looks at those stories and say they're mythic, they're not based in history, there's abundant archaeological evidence and the narratives of our ancestors that talk about our origins in the land of Israel. So the Jewish people were born in the land of Israel. The term Jew comes from the term Judea. We are the people from Judea. And our history is one of exile and return over millennia. So we were exiled during the Babylonian exile in 586 BCE, and Jews went throughout the Middle East at that time. A small portion, but that ended up becoming a significant portion of the Jewish people, came back to the land of Israel, built a second temple. Then we were expelled again in the year 70 CE. And we were spread in a diaspora that went throughout the Middle East, ultimately to Europe, to Africa, really every corner of the world. But that desire to return to our homeland never died. And there was always a portion of the Jewish people that continued to live in Israel. So sometimes there's this narrative that, all of us were gone and that Israel or Zion became a metaphor. But I think that that is not really intellectually honest. There have always been Jews that have lived in Israel. Before Israel was created, Jews were the majority in Jerusalem. And Jews have always returned to Israel during periods of exile or oppression from other lands. Most notably in 1492, when the Jews were kicked out of the Iberian Peninsula. A lot of Jews went back to Israel because they didn't know where else to go. We were exiled, we went to Europe, then we were in Spain. Then the Catholic Church kicked us out of Spain. They either said assimilate, die, or leave. And some Jews went to Turkey, and some went to Amsterdam, some went to the Americas, and then some went back to Israel and set up communities in Sfat and in Hebron. Went back to Jerusalem, Tiberias, all of these cities. And those Jewish communities, those Sephardic Jewish communities from Spain, stayed in Israel up until present day. And then, the other piece of it is the land of Israel is so important to us that whenever a Jew has died throughout history, a little satchel of soil from Israel is put in with the coffin. So when you're at a Jewish funeral home in Portland, Maine, in Bangor, or wherever it may be, the body is prepared for burial in the ancient ways we've always prepared bodies, and then a little piece of land, a little piece of soil, is put in there with them because we believe that during the time of the ultimate redemption, we'll all be brought back to our homeland in peace. So it's a very crucial part of our tradition. And then, starting in the mid 1880s, there was this movement, and it has many different strands that came together in the sort of creation of what we call political Zionism. A lot of what I spoke to is about the religious historical connection to the land. And then there's this movement, political Zionism, that comes out of the mid 1800s, out of the idea that we deserve the dignity of any other nation and we need protection. And the only place where we can set up a society where we can not be forced to assimilate, where we can't be a perpetual risk, is if we have a state of our own. And there were all sorts of discussions at the beginning of political Zionism. Does it matter that we go back to the land of Israel? Can we build a Jewish state in Argentina? Can we build a Jewish state in Uganda? These were all discussions in the early Zionist movement. And there were two reasons that the ultimate answer to those questions was no. One, we have no right to those lands. We have no historical connection to them, so why would we develop a state there? And the other is there was already concern in the Jewish community, as there was from the very beginning of Zionism. There were concerns about the accusations of colonialism, that we didn't want the Jewish national movement to be associated with some of the crimes that we saw in the colonial world. Now, does that mean that there weren't early Zionists that didn't appeal to colonial powers? They most certainly did. Were there Jews from Europe that carried with them colonial attitudes? Absolutely. But there was this sensitivity to that. And then ultimately, at the World Zionist Congress and in many of those conversations, they said, actually, the only place it makes sense to build a refuge, to build a place where Jewish community and culture can flourish, is in the land to which we have historical ties. And then what you saw was larger immigration during the Ottoman era of Jews from throughout the world going to the land of Israel. Now, some of those Jews were from Europe, and some of those Jews were from the Middle East and North Africa. And then what you would see over the course of the creation of the State of Israel is different Jewish immigrants from different parts of the world coming to establish a home there. And that's the Cliff Notes version, but I'm happy to take additional questions. And I will just say to your listeners, for everything that I'm saying, there are 100 things that I'm leaving out, and I just want to put out there that there's a lot of complexity to this story, and I hope, Donna, through your questions and your challenges, we can get to some more of that complexity.
Well, okay. So, what does Zionism, what's the definition of that?
Different people define it in different ways, which is something you're going to hear a lot from me. There's debate within Jewish community and Jewish history about what Zionism means. And then there's what Zionism means to other people, specifically to Palestinians. And so you can have one word that has a very clear set of meanings to one group of people and means something very different to another. I think that the normative opinion within the Jewish community, and for most of the history of the State of Israel, is that Zionism is the belief that Jewish people have the right to live in their historic homeland in a state of their own. But within the Zionist movement, there's a lot of diversity. There is binational Zionism, there's liberal Zionism, there's revisionist Zionism, there's socialist Zionism. I don't know which ones I said. There are many different streams of Zionism. The socialist Zionists say that the only way you can create a Jewish state is if it has socialist aspects to its economy, because that was the vision of our prophets. You have revisionist Zionism that believes, at least it used to, not so much anymore, believed that in the values of the Enlightenment and that those need to be a crucial part of the Jewish state. There are religious Zionists who believe that a Jewish state has to be religious, and most of those people believe that that form of religion has to be orthodoxy, and they still exist today. And then there's binational Zionism that believes in a Jewish homeland, but not necessarily a Jewish state. And that those have always been a minority of voices, but they've existed from the beginning of the Zionist movement, that you can have a Jewish homeland that lives in confederation with a Palestinian one. You know, it's often said that the early Zionists said that Israel was a land without a people for a people without a land. Actually, the Jewish Zionists never said that. That's actually a statement of a Christian Zionist from the United Kingdom. The Jewish people always knew that there were Palestinians there. They always knew that there was an Arab population, in no small part because they lived there. So if you look at early Zionist writings, they were always engaging with this question. They had different answers to it. But all this is to say, within the Jewish community, it's the belief that the Jewish people have a right to live in their historic homeland, in dignity and in peace. Now, Zionism means something very different to Palestinians. To a lot of Palestinians, Zionism means colonialism and dispossession. And I think that part of the challenge at this moment is really in how the tension between those definitions. Is one right, is one wrong, or are they both right and they live in a certain type of tension that we haven't found a way to resolve? And depending on who you speak to, they're going to give you different answers to that question.
You know, it kind of brings to mind this country. When we started, forming this country, there were all kinds of different interests and beliefs and nationalism and federalism and this and that. And that's still going on. And we never solved that. When you look at the Civil War, we're still fighting that Civil War. And I don't, in my personal opinion, and I might get a lot of crap for what I'm going to say, but in my own personal opinion, I wonder if we actually won that Civil War, because there are still lots of resentment and hatred and racism still in there. So yeah, so I can understand from a native perspective, all of that stuff. And it is complicated, and I think it's complicated on purpose. So that it's not easily understood by lots of people.
That's true. And we're not living in an age that and I don't even say this with judgment. I used to say it with judgment, but now I think I feel this way with a lot more compassion. It's very hard to hold all of those forms of complexity because I think that we live in a world that isn't designed for human flourishing. And so our ability to hold painful complexity is really diminished at this moment. And, you know, just to add to that complexity, you have this conflict. I mean, the conflict that we see, there are all those different forms of Zionism I told you about. They're still at war within Israel. And Israel was on a verge of a civil war before October 7th. Anybody who's honest will tell you that that was the case. And it's not just two sides, there are like multiple different people and camps that are fighting with each other. There are tribes within our tribe. And by the way, Palestinian society is the same. There's no solitary Palestinian voice. That is also a diverse society with multiple competing interests and various proposed solutions to the tragedies that have befallen the Palestinian people. And so, what you have are really two communities that are very much at war with each other as they're at war. There's an internal war, and then there's the war with each other. Like, both all of those things exist at the same time. Which is part of the reason that when people say there's a very easy solution to this, there really isn't. And I wish there were. I like, honest to God, I look at this conflict, and for somebody like me, I've lived in Israel for a long time. I have very deep familial connections to Israel. You know, this heartbreak isn't new. It might be extreme at this current moment, but you know, the harm that Israelis and Palestinians have done to each other for well over a century. It's really heartbreaking. And there's an element, if you fully absorb the pain and the conflict, there's a lot of not just heartbreak, but of a moral disgust of the types of things that Israelis and Palestinians have done to each other for a long time. And I wish that there was a way to get people to stop. But it is extraordinarily difficult when, Israelis and Palestinians actually know each other in a sense. They don't know each other at all, and they know each other extremely well. It's this interesting thing, especially post the Second Intifada. I actually lived in Israel during that time period, during bus bombings and all sorts of violence, and then increased violent occupation after the First Intifada. I mean, plenty of bad things between them. The Israeli government started putting up fences and walls between the Israeli and the Palestinian population in order to defend the Israeli population. Of course, through that process, there was also land grabs that had nothing to do with security. So it was like both and. But one of the greatest tragedies of that, even if you believe that it's necessary for Israel's security, which I understand, I lived with a lot of fear when I lived there, but that the organic interaction between Israelis and Palestinians was severely diminished at that time. And so Israelis and Palestinians used to know each other better and have more organic interaction than they used to have. But for the older generations, they actually do understand each other's narratives well enough to weaponize the trauma of the other against each other. So, October 7th, Yahya Sinwar, who was the mastermind of October 7th, he was in Israeli prisons for a long time, spoke fluent Hebrew, knew Jewish history very well, knew Israeli history very well, and part of the architecture of that attack was to elicit images of the Holocaust, because he knew that that is what would provoke an extreme response that would lead to Israel doing things that would lead to the breakdown of peace talks with Saudi Arabia and the ultimate isolation of Israel from the family of nations. And guess what? He was right. It totally worked. And then after October 7th, you heard people within Israel saying, we are going to bring about another Nakba. Nakba is the word for the tragedy that befell Palestinians in 1948, as many Palestinians were dispossessed or chose to leave, both fled, all of the above in 1948, and people were alienated and exiled from their homelands that they had lived in for centuries. And so you have these. And again, some people might get upset with me. I'm not comparing the two. I'm not comparing trauma and trauma. I'm not comparing pain. I know that will get nowhere good. What I am saying is that there's enough of understanding of that experience in the other to really hit at that wound that then exacerbates the reaction to those things. And, I think as a rabbi, what I hope for, as somebody who's deeply invested in dignity and justice for Palestinians and Israelis, is that we can get to a point that we can use our trauma and our pain for empathy as opposed for building a case against the other. And I say that with full acknowledgement that there are all sorts of power differentials that are actually very complex between Israelis and Palestinians right now. But I think on a deeper religious level, if not a political one, that's my prayer. Whether or not it's realistic or not.
So this you may I may this may cause you to go back over something you just said, but
Sure.
I wonder if what do you think of like the key moments historically between shape that shape the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, like the Balfour Declaration or the Holocaust or the founding of Israel in 1948. What do you think? What are the key?
There are so many,
Yes.
there are so many, and when you make those choices, you are privileging some narratives over others. Let me say that. So,
Well, you don't
at
have to
the
answer it if you don't want to.
no, I mean, I think that there are important landmarks, like, I think the writing of early Zionist writings, the Dreyfus Affair is often seen as the important moment in the creation of political Zionism when Theodor Herzl looked at this trial of a French Jew in the French military and saw that he was tried for treason that he did not commit and that the scales were weighed against him. And he looked at that and he said, we can never live freely as Jews in Europe. Like, this story is broken. And it's not going to get better. And he turned out to be right. A lot of times people say Israel was created in reaction to the Holocaust. That's not true. Jews around the world saw that the emancipation and the Enlightenment in Europe offered a false promise, namely that if Jews gave up their distinctiveness and their faith, and they just adopted the identity of citizen, that they could be safe and live freely and with dignity in worlds that were European or colonized by Europe. And there were people who saw the reality of what was happening in Europe, and also Jews throughout the Middle East and the North Africa that were treated as second and third class citizens in the lands of their origins. And a lot of Jews at the same time were like, this isn't working anymore. And I think that's an important part of the story. And so, there are all sorts of moments. The Hebron massacre of old Yishuv Jews, of Sephardic Jews in Hebron, in the early part of the 1900s by Palestinians who saw Jewish refugees as colonists and fought in that way. There's 1948, the creation of the State of Israel. That was also the Nakba. It was both at the same time. I mean, probably one of the most crucial dates is 1967, when Israel not only defended its borders, but then it went in and it took the West Bank and Gaza. And there were big debates within Israel about what we should do with those lands. The West Bank was previously under Jordanian control, Gaza was previously under Egyptian control. There were voices in Israel that wanted to give those lands back. Jordan and Egypt did not want to take them. And then there were voices that said, this is God's will. We should settle it and create, and this should be a new part of Israel as part of this religious mission. And then there were people who said, if we start building houses here, we're going to end up in a mess we can't get out of. And guess what? That's precisely what happened. And, Palestinians have risen up against Zionists, Jews, Israelis throughout this story. And in the late 1980s, they did rise up. And there are those iconic images in East Jerusalem of children throwing stones at Israeli soldiers. Because this idea that a lot of Israelis had that if we give the Palestinians small parcels of land and a certain amount of economic strength, if we bring enough economic vitality to the Palestinian population, they'll be contented to live a life without citizenship or collective self-determination. And that was a dangerous self-delusion. And there were plenty of early Zionists that knew that that was a dangerous self-delusion. But a lot of Israelis either were concerned with survival or with other questions to actually face that question head on. And in many ways, we're here now because that question unanswered still remains. So, a lot of times the Balfour Declaration is brought up about the British, and I'm not going to say that it isn't important, but there were plenty of guarantees made by colonial powers to Arab leaders as well, right? And Jews started returning and buying land in Israel when Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire. So the British and French occupation and colonization of the Middle East, it's important, but it's only a slice in a much larger saga that actually expands through many empires and many interacting or interwoven historical events.
I always wondered why is it that no matter where the Jews went, they were like treated as outcasts and not accepted? And why?
I teach classes on this, Donna. I mean, so there are many different theories of anti-Semitism. There are many different theories about why it is. I think the best book that was written on this topic is a book called Anti-Judaism by David Nierenberg, who is at the University of Chicago. It's like 500 pages. Our students never want to read it, but like it's the best thing. I think the bottom line for me, when I look at all of these different theories, there are people who say that, we're racially inferior. or that there is an invisible conspiracy of Jews to use our power and our money to oppress other people. There's the Christian idea that Jews killed Jesus, the Islamic idea that we're dhimmis, that we're not, of equal status. But actually, I think, and all of those stories sort of express themselves in different ways in different times throughout history. But I actually think at the core of anti-Semitism is this idea of Jews are perceived as a nation within a nation. We're seen as a threat because we maintained our collective identity in the countries where we were dispersed, and we refused to give up on our traditions and our sense of collective self. And in every empire and in every nation, there was always this expectation that Jews would give up their difference in the sake of national cohesion, fidelity to the empire, wherever it may be. And because, a lot of Jews did assimilate and a lot of Jews continue to assimilate. But for the Jews who don't assimilate, we raise suspicion and ire. And of course, the irony of that is that even among the Jews who do assimilate, we are all ultimately victims of that same anti-Semitism. Like many of the problems that I've discussed with you, Donna, like, do I know the solution to it? No. The early Zionists thought that Israel was the answer to anti-Semitism. And as we can see, that is not true, right? There's still plenty of anti-Semitism in the world. The idea that Israel has quashed anti-Semitism because the world now respects what we can contribute or do, or that we're more normal because we have a country of our own. I say this as a Zionist, but like it has not solved the problem of anti-Semitism. It is now part of an anti-Semitic narrative in a whole host of ways. And the irony or the complication at this point, I think, is best articulated by Amos Oz. He was a Israeli novelist and peace activist. He was very critical of the Israeli government and the occupation, but he was also very defensive of Israel's right to exist. And what he said was, when I was a child growing up in Europe, the graffiti everywhere as I was spit at on the street, they said, "Jews go back to Palestine." And now that I'm in Palestine, everybody spits at me and says, "Go back to Europe." And so, what's the solution there? And, I don't think Israelis can go back to Europe for those of them that are in Europe. But of course, this point often gets lost. The majority of Jews in Israel are not European. The majority of Jews in Israel are refugees from the Middle East and North Africa. They came before the creation of the State of Israel. They came in large waves in the 50s and 60s. There were Nazi-inspired pogroms against the Jews of Baghdad before the creation of the State of Israel. There was violent repression against the Jews of Yemen and Iran. They can't go back to the Middle East, right? They would be slaughtered. They have no place to go back to. And I'm not so sure Jews are safe in Europe either. The chief rabbi of France said 5 years ago, "The age of French Jewry is over. I encourage all of my children to leave." So it's just this question of a lot of people have simplistic answers to these questions, but nobody really has an answer to where we're supposed to go. The other answer to that question is often America. But I don't think America is going to accept 6 million Jewish refugees. America did not accept a lot of Jewish refugees during the Holocaust, right? And the idea that the American ideal of multiculturalism is a bulwark against nationalism or racism or anti-Semitism has proven itself to be extraordinarily false. So the question is, where do we go? And that is, one of the core questions and struggles that we're all facing at this moment.
Then before I forget, Darren, welcome. You came on
Hello.
a bit later into the show, but you had things you had to do. What your phrase of nation within a nation, very familiar to tribes. Very, I'm curious about that. I just want to get that out there. But Darren, since you haven't had a chance to say anything, what's on your mind?
Oh yeah, no. From what I've been hearing in the last couple minutes by Rachel, and great to meet you and join you guys in discussion around something that's so critical. Yeah, I mean it. the calling out, right? It strikes me that in an age of social media, where you can say anything anywhere and seeming. Although I did just read that potentially the Secretary of State might be monitoring our social media if we say something wrong or against certain entities, including Israel. I think they said that our passports might be limited. So that's an interesting thing for the absolutists of free speech on the right. But I think that, that distillation of like calling out one way or the other, and then to think seriously about solutions, in the idea that, I mean, I know of, Palestinians and Israelis who have been, on many front lines, for decades, trying to, first and foremost, see each other as kin and as relations, and in the ways in which we as indigenous people would ask. And then, what does it mean, to speak clearly and call out injustice and the violation of human rights, and then call for, our higher selves and higher minds, like the grandmothers in that statement do, and that. But there are Palestinian and Jewish grandmothers that are saying similar statements. Honestly, if you're interested enough, that all the way through from October 7th in this most recent thing, right on day one, like Israeli grandmothers saying, "Don't, don't make this a way to, denigrate, a way to wage an absolute destructive war," which has happened, because of this, because of what's happened today or yesterday. So I think, we don't hear a lot of those voices that are more local, honestly, and we should. And then I think that's why, again, I think for the grandmothers, the Maliseet, the Wolastoqe grandmothers, they represented quite well. And I mean, I'd love to see a dialogue, around the higher mind of their statement with statements from Palestinian grandmothers and Israeli or Jewish grandmother. Like I would love to see almost like a dialogue to center what's next, to center our fight for justice, as opposed to the calling out, which we can all do in terms of what are clearly violations of human rights, and fundamentally, and then to really like, what is it that would shift the narratives, collectively here in the US and in Israel? Like, it feels very stuck, obviously these last 2 years or whatever, of that period of time, has kind of created a cover, right, for some really bad things to happen. And how do we move past that? I mean, it just feels very stuck. And I again, like you, Rachel, I don't pretend to know, besides calling for peace, repeatedly in my social media or wherever. I don't know, my voice, doesn't distill it, but I think, what we have here with Donna is a platform to call for this approach. And I think that's, and Donna did this. We were together the other night down in Gardner talking about tribal sovereignty, and she again brought up, the grandmother's statement, to just be like, let's not lose track of what's happening in the world around us. And so I just, yeah, those are my initial comments about what we're facing.
So, Rachel, you had some comments about the grandmother's statements earlier. You want to?
Yeah, so I want to pull it up because I think that Darren points out some really important things. And by the way, in terms of the Israeli and Palestinian grandmothers, there's an organization that's existed for a long time. It's called the Bereaved Parents Circle. and it brings together Israeli and Palestinian parents who've lost children through war, through terrorism, through hatred. And they put out, this was years ago, because unfortunately this has had to exist for a long time. They put out this ad campaign on Israeli TV that just says, "We don't want your child to be next." So, you know, those voices do exist, but when people are angry and when people are traumatized and hurt, it's very hard to listen to those voices that are calling for something better. But one of the things that I really appreciated about the statement is they believe that dignity belongs to all peoples. We have long followed a path of non-interference, respecting the sovereignty and self-determination of other nations. They can't be silent in the face of what's happening in Gaza. They recognize and identify with the pain of Palestinian mothers. And at the same time, they say we do not speak to assign blame or deepen wounds. We speak as women who understand that healing begins with recognition of pain, of injustice, and of shared humanity. That all peoples have a right to live in safety, dignity, and peace on their ancestral lands. This includes our Palestinian relatives who are suffering now and demands the attention of compassion of those who are in the world. And I think what's very powerful about what they're saying is, I think they give specific voice to Palestinians in their statement because of the tens of thousands of Palestinians who have been killed and the destruction in their homes. But they're making very clear it's not at the expense of Israelis or Jews, and that they're not trying to deepen the trauma or the wounds to others. And I think that that's a wisdom that comes with age. Not to be ageist, but I think that there's a wisdom in that approach, that the idea of wounding somebody else in the expense of protecting somebody else's dignity, no matter how righteous one's intention, isn't necessarily the path to healing. It hasn't been, in my experience as a rabbi dealing with individuals, or I think in the context of this conflict. And I do have to say, like, you know, Darren, it was challenging for me. There was one point where I felt like some of that trauma was being tread upon in the previous episode. You know, there was one point at which, you know, one of the guests said that Israeli settlers, ones that were doing terrible things, but nonetheless, reminded her of dogs. And I was just sort of like, comparing Jews to animals, you know, regardless of the context, that's really dangerous. Because what we've seen is, look at our neighbor to the north, Canada, that's even worse than the United States. What began as protests against Israel has now led to the firebombings of synagogues and graffiti that says that the Jews were behind 9/11. I think that we're dealing with very hot stuff. And a lot of the people who think they know how to control it don't. I think a lot of the people who think that they know what anti-Semitism is and how it operates don't really know, because if they did, they wouldn't be using that kind of language. And so, you know, one of the things that I, you know, it was difficult for me to listen to some of that stuff also with the sort of use of the Holocaust as a word and universalizing it without its particular religious and historical context for the Jewish people, or associating American Jews with the crime of Israel, which was something else that happened about the Minnesota Jewish community being held responsible for the crimes of Israel and Zionism. So all of those types of things actually felt very un they did not feel like they were taking the wisdom from the grandmother's statement that could call out human rights abuses,
Yeah.
that identified the pain, but then had a path toward healing that actually, A, had no anti-Semitism in it whatsoever, and B, it seems went out of its way to sort of assuage the wounds and the fear of the Jewish community and Israelis. So, like, I am curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the challenges I see is and this is you know, I'm not gonna no way, I'm not attacking anyone. I think what it brings up for Indigenous people, I mean, I think this is why oftentimes, you know, I see indigenous people in the North American context as we participate in these discussions, and I think we should, and I think we should never be silent about these fundamental issues around the rights of people and the suffering of people we see as kin in certain ways. I think it is like a little bit of our trauma responses too, like that it's filtered through, for us, to be an activist, in the context, with one of the guests, pipeline activism, and with another one in educational activism, they've been on the front lines, right? They've been, hurled things at physically. They've been doxxed, and they've been, for Winona, part of state and associated state violence against people praying for the protection of water. I think it's hard to, I think that's why that higher mind of grandmothers is so important to recognize. And how do you articulate that war crimes are ongoing, in a clear fashion that is clearly a part of state violence in other forms around the globe, that forms of state violence that the United States has participated in, it happens to be at a seemingly a scale that was only hinted at by previous United States incursions, using basically the same tools and strategies of destroying centers of healing, destroying the ability of people to even line up and gather resources for feeding themselves. And I think, not excusing it or anything, I do think like the collectivity of trauma that as Indigenous people we kind of feel and sort of want to call out the state, which is something Donna and I and others do on this program regularly. our own state of Maine, our glorious state of Maine, and what that is. I think, this is one of the challenges of the time. I think, there's so much driven in language around and associated, forms of not only anti-Semitism, right, which our language is built up, for in the U.S. for as long as there was the U.S., but also those frameworks of Orientalism that Edward Said talked about in terms of the othering of, Muslims and Middle Eastern and folk, like there's a whole sort of, in some ways, ironically, I think actually the frameworks of Orientalism and anti-Semitism have some very similar origins, right? Rachel, you're
Yeah, I mean,
right.
no, I think that they
Yeah.
are extraordinarily similar
Yeah.
about understanding the self
Yeah.
through creating this flattened, less than human other. It's actually, there's a lot of commonality between Orientalism and anti-Semitism.
Yeah, and I think, as much as we know, like we talk about things like mascots or things like that also kind of ring true or have a valence, like that are seen as quote unquote merely symbolic, right? But the merely symbolic, right, that is dehumanizing, allows for all the other pieces, right? Like, in my opinion, a legacy of mascots and dehumanization and, dependency and paternalism, right? Those are all tied together. If you don't see someone as fully human, you can make them into a mascot or whatever, then that allows you to do all sorts of other things that are attached to state violence, right? And all those forms. So I think I'm hopeful that the wisdom of the grandmothers clearly speaks from that place, though, right? They and Donna has documented and spoken about this too, like the ways in which especially Indigenous women have been categorized and dehumanized, and that directly reflects on the issues that we face in the public policy realm, where the violence of Indigenous women is so much more than and other people, right? So much more than other groups of people. So I think, quote unquote, the merely symbolic and the languages that we use and call for peace and calling out people, these matter as well. So I'd say, like, yeah, it feels very interconnected to our collective work. And again, Donna mentioned that, right, in the throes of a discussion around our own tribal sovereignty and what it feels like, gets in the way of being seen and trusted with the ability to control our own destinies, like things like that. You dig deep into like the statements of people resisting our sovereignty. It definitely feels like it's attached to language of dehumanization or not trusting us as us, so yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that all feels very familiar. And I think that that is relevant in many ways, in different ways, especially right now for both Israelis and Palestinians. You know, the question is, where do you go from here?
I'll tell you where you don't go.
Tell me where you don't go,
Don't go
Donna.
into a dog fight.
Yep.
You back off and say, "We, that was not right to say. I apologize for that. Let's look at each other on a person to person, human being to human being level, and try to make some sense out of stuff instead of trying to kill each other."
Which is like that's the elder. I mean, that's the approach that I think at times I've been accused with in maybe my younger days of like by elders. Donna hasn't had to do this too much with me, but the idea that we get over our skis a little bit in terms of reacting through trauma and through just being like it's wrong. Like we need to let people know it's wrong, and how we conduct ourselves through passion and clarity. That's our diplomacy is has all sorts of tools though for us to engage in the in those spaces. And I think it's always like I think about like Wayne Newell or other people who are like. And they don't even articulate this, Donna. Like, some of the elders are like, you can tell that they always go after someone's heart first. Like it's always the heart first and not the politics or any of the other stuff. They're like, how do I reach you in terms of your condition as another human being? And like, what does that mean? And then how do we build out from that common experience? And I think, yeah, that's always kind of be, the critical framework for us too.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I just want to say this. One of the things that I appreciate about the grandmothers is they weren't silent. You know, they say we can't bear this silence, but the way in which they speak is a way that has moral clarity, but it doesn't dehumanize anybody else. Even though I can understand the rage of what's happening, the rage that people feel over what's happening in Gaza, within my community, the rage of what happened on October 7th. It was the largest number of Jews killed on a single day since the Holocaust. And a lot of our children are still being held hostage, and the images of babies coming home in coffins because they were strangled to death by Hamas hostages, right? So tens of thousands of Palestinian kids killed, hungry, malnourished, right? Like, there is so much to be outraged by. And yet, the wisdom of a sort of tribal religious tradition is there is a place for that anger and that disgust and that repulsion. There is a place to speak out, but the way in which we speak out matters. And I think it's very hard during this moment of polarization and of a moment of like really intense cruelty, to actually hold the position that they hold. Because I'm sure there's a lot of judgment for having balancing speaking out with that kind of grace. But I think there's a lot of wisdom there, and it's better than anything else that I'm seeing. So I think what they show is that you can exercise moral judgment with humility and kindness. And I hope that we can actually learn from that moving forward, because actually it's one of the rare things that I've read in the face of this tragedy that I'm actually like, I think they're getting it right.
Me too. So, Darren, because you've only had a few minutes with us and we've only got a couple minutes left, I'm going to let you have the last word.
Oh, Donna, yes. I just came from my environmental justice class. One of the things that we talk about in that class is the idea of there's a framework in critical environmental justice that sees one element of creating injustice as the idea that certain people are dispensable or certain places are dispensable. And I think that that both for people and places, for us as Indigenous people, because we see rights as tied to our relations with non-humans, right? We don't see them only categorized by human rights, right? That we, because of our relations, are connected to the non-human world, and that I was just mentioning to my class, the Penobscot Nation is a citizen of the Penobscot River is a citizen of the Penobscot Nation. And there that I could see some of my students just like, oh, what does that mean? That we're thinking about caretaking beyond just other people, and to place, and to not just see, Gaza or Palestinians or Israelis or the West Bank or like places. Once you start to sort of reckon with the idea of places as dispensable, as people as dispensable, right? That's clearly, even if it portends to certain forms of economic logics, right? Like, I think a lot of people accept in global capitalism that there is, and since the Industrial Revolution, like that there has been places that are the wasteland created by the economic engines, right? And I just don't think any of us can accept that. I just don't think anyone of, and I think that's where why Indigenous people, I think, much like the grandmother statement around things like climate justice or any of those kinds of issues, have become such critical figures in it because they're not willing to sacrifice, willing to say that there is a place of sacrifice in our world or a people to be sacrificed in our world.
Thank you for joining us today. We have heard from Rabbi Rachel Isaacs and Professor Darren Ranko, who help us see the deep history, memory, and survival that shape both the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and our own indigenous struggles here in Wabanaki homelands. We are grateful for their wisdom and honesty. Until next time, I'm Donna Loring. Wooly one.